It is July 26, 2011. I am Steve Gerwick, the webmaster of Gerwick.net. And today we have a special guest from Kayfabe Commentaries, Sean Oliver. And I like to say up front that Kayfabe Commentaries have a lot of great titles, and you definitely should check out their website if you're interested in guest booker or a U-shoot. Has a lot of interesting titles and has been a sponsor with Gerwick.net, as we said, for a long time. We do appreciate his business. And today I give you Sean Oliver. How you doing, Sean?
You're giving me away, and they can have me. How are you? Gerwick.net should be the on everybody's favorite list there on the side of your browser. Definitely, it's been a great spot. I'm happy we are able to park our banner there every month. We're pretty judicious with who we advertise with, and I think you guys have always done us proud.
Well, we appreciate that, and of course, Sean's banner changes from time to time with whichever his current title is. And I guess before we get into specific titles and some of your series that you do promote and create, tell us a little bit about Kayfabe Commentaries, the history of the company, and I guess how it came to be.
We originally launched over 4 years ago now with our first product was alternate commentary tracks. For wrestling matches, we would have the talent come in, watch the matches in real time with me on headset, and record an alternate audio track, very much like on a DVD. If you buy a DVD and you watch the movie with the alternate track, you could hear the director perhaps talking about how a shot was set up or how something was done. But we thought that that would be a good option for wrestling matches, bringing the participants in the historic wrestling matches that we've all seen and have them talk us through them, almost as if we were watching the match with them sitting on next to us on the couch. It was an aspect of the business, that aspect of the wrestling product that we'd never seen before. So we first launched with that, thus the commentaries and kayfabe commentaries. But it soon became apparent that we were going to need to move into video. If you were ever going to make a profit, we were selling it very cheap. I think it was $3 per commentary downloadable on the internet. And we had this concept for Guest Booker, and that was the first DVD we launched with. We didn't even necessarily think it was going to be series-based. We put it out there to see how it would be received, and people ate it up. You know, concept being we bring an actual booker in and have them on camera rebook an era in wrestling that that they were not involved with at the time. So to the layperson, I usually describe it like getting the writers of Friends in the same room and forcing them to write an episode of Star Trek and taping the creative process and how that would evolve. So then after the success of that, we kind of realized that, hey, you know, we could base this model on a network or a studio-type system where it can be episodic. We can have multiple releases of this guest booker. Then, as we had put a few of them out, we came up with the concept for U-Shoot and said, well, you know what, we can really kind of run this more like a television network and manage several series, all with different identities, all with a kind of a different look and a different personality to each one. Thematically, would they be a little different? But all be consistent in some way, you know, and I think the thoroughfare of our work is that it's produced very professionally and slickly, to a degree that shoot DVD industry had not seen up to that point. Shoot DVDs had not really graduated past the stage they were at when they were born in the mid-90s, so, you know, almost 20 years worth of, 15 years worth of the same kind of thing. So so we sought to change that a little bit, and I think we did.
Yeah, I think you guys do a really good job. I think you guys are very innovative. I like your different titles. Obviously, the U-Shoot gives a chance for the fans out there to ask questions of their favorite wrestling personalities. And, you know, one thing we've seen with the DVDs is obviously, you know, Sean Oliver is the interviewer, but, you know, a lot of us don't know a lot about about you. What's your background? Where'd you come from? And obviously, talk about maybe some of the favorite wrestlers you had growing up.
Well, you know, the star of the series and the star of our stuff is certainly the talent that we're all there to hear about. I look at myself like a function, kind of like maybe the chain that runs across on your bicycle that, you know, that's down by the pedal. I see myself as the chain. You know, people look at the bike and they go, oh, what a nice bike. Look at the colors on that. And then they get on it, they ride it around. They go, my God, now this thing rides like nothing else. But, you know, I prefer to be kind of like the chain in a way. My background, I grew up in the Northeast, so I was a product of the McMahon Senior's WWWS TV. Beaming across my glorious, gigantic black and white television every Saturday. It always diminished the effect of the blood. You know, someone would open their head for my edification as a fan. And you know what? I'm watching it on a black and white TV. It really didn't pop. I really didn't pop like I should have.
Not the same effects for sure.
But, you know, we, it was an exciting time because having discovered it right there in the late 70s, there wasn't the multitude of competition for one's attention on television and in entertainment. There was no cable at the time yet, or we didn't have it anyway. You know, there was five channels, and that was it. There was no VCR, there were no DVDs, you could play Pong on your Atari if you really wanted to, but so it was easy to get hooked on something like that. And then when cable came along, it exposed us in the Northeast to a multitude of territories that had cable access. Like, I remember World Class was coming across on what was MSG Network at the time, so we're exposed to the Dallas territory. We were getting AWA via ESPN. This is a little later, you know, early 80s, mid-80s. We were getting, for a brief time before Vince got on USA Network, we were getting the Mid-Atlantic broadcast. We were getting Mid-Atlantic actually on a VHF channel also. For anyone under 30 years old, you don't need to know what VHF is. Just, or UHF, I guess. What was the one with like the 100 numbers on the bottom?
I think that was UHF. Yeah.
That was UHF.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
So on a UHF channel, we could get the NWA Mid-Atlantic broadcast. So you know, that was a glorious time because almost any day of the week you had wrestling. You used to have to wait once a week. You used to have to wait to watch the angle evolve. Every week, once a week on Saturday, what'll happen? What will Bruno do next week? We'll hear about the results of the big card at the Garden. Yeah, I think in the late 70s they weren't televising any of the Garden cards because there was no cable. I mean, they were recording them, but I don't know where they were broadcasting them. Anyway, so then finally when cable came in, we were able to see everything. Well, not everything, but a lot of other territories and learn new talent and get wrestling almost every day. It was a really, really great time to be a wrestling fan. We had options, unlike today. Well, you got a couple of options today, but it was so much more exciting back then. But what with all the magazines also, you could really – it was a special thing to be able to have – market knowledge like that, knowledge of the entire wrestling market. It wasn't as easy as it is today. So it was something you had to pursue, and it was with a great deal of satisfaction that a wrestling fan could be knowledgeable across several different territories, ones that their local market didn't carry.
Now you bring back some great memories, you know, watching wrestling on television before there was really cable. I remember, you know, watching AWA or syndicated Mid-South wrestling that we would get. Channel 9 out of Windsor would have international championship wrestling with Abdullah the Butcher and Bruiser Brody. And those two would have feuds all the time. Bloodbass. I mean, it was just some great Dino Bravo came from there as well. I mean, just great memories. And obviously, you know, the wrestling we see today is so much different than what we grew up watching. I mean, I remember – 6:05 Saturday nights, you know, when we had WTBS, was you had to watch the Crockett shows, and you look back at the Crockett shows, and most of them were squash matches. And today, you know, they try to put on an entertaining show, have competitive matches. But I remember watching hours and hours of Crockett shows, and even
AWA shows, jobber matches.
And you were still entertained by it because it was personalities. I mean, the person, like when Ric Flair would came, when the Horseman came out to the little stand there with Tony Schiavone, that was entertaining. That they didn't have to wrestle, or Tully Blanchard, or
Dusty.
Garvins. Yeah, Dusty Rhodes. I mean, Ricky and Robert would come out and cut a promo. That was entertainment. Today we're so given all these, you know, somewhat competitive matches, and there's the personalities are kind of pushed to the background.
Yeah, and I don't, and it's, we could talk about it, like the chicken and the egg kind of thing. I mean, is it today's talent to blame? Is it today's creative to blame? Where did that paradigm shift happen where one could want to be a wrestler? You know, it's a funny thing. In 1975, if you said you want, first of all, you probably wouldn't say you wanted to be a professional wrestler. Just because of the protected nature of what was going on. But if you wanted to be a professional wrestler, there are a few prerequisites that you had to hit first in order to be successful. And you know what? Strangely enough, your in-ring, flippy-doo type stuff, you know, your in-ring performance was almost secondary to you being able to walk into a promoter's office and have a third eye in the middle of your forehead. If you walked in that way, it almost didn't matter what you could do in the ring because, hey, we're going to have somebody show you. But you're unique in some way. You're special, and you're going to jump through the television set to people. Man, when you open your mouth, people are going to want to listen to you. Man, when you take your shirt off and you're covered with fur and we'll paint your tongue green, you're going to be interesting. Man, you're 7 feet tall. People are going to want to watch you. Man, look at that head of hair. And you're really from Samoa also? Sign on the dotted line. There was a whole different set of criteria at the time. Character. But you had to be genuinely unique in some way to the point where you would stand out in a room. If I dropped 90% of today's roster in either federation, in a room with other professional athletes, other baseball players, other football players, other weightlifters, the lay person would be hard-pressed to pick out the professional wrestlers. In 1979, if I filled the room with NFL players and dropped in Andre the Giant, Abdullah the Butcher, Bruiser Brody, the Samoans, the Grand Wizard, Superstar Billy Graham, King Kong Bundy, Gary Hart, do you not think we would easily be able to say either there's a bunch of wrestlers in this room or the circus just came to town?
Yeah, I mean, you I don't know what it is either. You know, is it too much television? Is it too many pay-per-views? I think one of the things that when you go back from 80s, 90s into today was if you grew up watching wrestling in the 80s, like I think we both did, I mean, even the 70s, going back to that period, was that the wrestlers came from territories. They wrestled for years in a certain territory. They'd come from the Northeast, or they'd come from the Northwest, or they'd come from Canada. They'd come from Memphis. They'd come from Florida. They'd come from Texas. And they had a legacy there. They wrestled in front of fans. They were very comfortable there. They could actually wrestle different styles because they were in different territories. Mm-hmm. And today's mentality is, let's sign somebody, even if they're a good worker, train them in Florida, show them the style we want them to work, not really give him a chance to develop a character, in 6 months put him on television and expect him to get over. I think that's just one example with TNA or WWE, but that seems to be the mentality of today's booking because, you know, I look at it like from Vince McMahon's perspective, he certainly could raid some talent from TNA, and I think there'd be a lot of guys from TNA that he could bring over and do something with, but he would rather do this, sign a guy from wherever he is, send him down to Florida, teach him his own style, and then bring him to television, give him some hokey character and say, okay, go out there and be somebody and get over with the fans.
Well, you know, it's easier. It's easier because it's an assembly line now. You know, it's what Henry Ford had in mind, and that's how wrestling's run. I always end up saying this when I talk about wrestling, whether it's from what, how we're discussing it now, or even just the constant comparisons to the entertainment industry by, I mean, WWE is very guilty of that. Wrestling is different. It's different than anything else out there. It can't be compared to anything, and it can't be run like anything. It's got to be treated very differently. It's a different animal. And, you know, the assembly line thing works with other things. I don't know that it captures the heart and the essence of what professional wrestling used to be. It's now just a scripted athletic event. And it may have been a scripted athletic event back then, but it was about something so much more. It was a mystique. There was something in the gumbo that got you addicted. And you need more than just a scripted athletic event, because it's a damn scripted athletic event. You've got to have something else to keep people coming back. And it was that. It was that mystique. It was those unique characters. It was the protected nature of the business. Now, I know you can't put the animals back in the barn, whatever the hell that saying is, but, you know, kayfabe is dead, but maybe there's something else. Maybe there's another way to do it. They got real close with the Punk thing. It's the closest they've gotten since maybe the Survivor Series thing in 97 of making people guess, blurring that line of what's real and what isn't. But of course they went and blew it and had him show back up on the TV last night. And you know, I mean, they just all over everything they tried to build, but that's the element that's gone. That's the element that's missing. And for Vince, I understand he's 65 years old now. It's much easier to set up the assembly line and let the kids and the in-law kids come in and run it that way. I mean, the locker room in Madison Square Garden in 1981 probably felt like, you know, wrangling wild animals. And who wants to do that 300 days a year? But in doing that, it was the heart of what wrestling really was. It still had one foot back in Carney, and it was so much more interesting. That's the thing about it. I try to watch the product. I can usually only get about a half hour at a time, but it's just not interesting anymore. You feel the same?
Yeah, I definitely. I tell you what, if I didn't have this website and doing what I'm doing on a regular basis, it's definitely hard for me, because If I order a three-hour pay-per-view, the pay-per-view seem like they're just a three-hour Raw or three-hour SmackDown or three-hour Impact, and it's just there's nothing special about them. Sometimes the wrestling's good, sometimes it's not. It's kind of hit and miss. I definitely agree with that. And you know, I think, in fact, I talked to a lot of my friends that, you know, grew up in the same period that we did. They'd say, yeah, I might DVR a show and watch it in 30 minutes. Or I think like Smith Hart on Twitter the other day said he watched a couple months worth of TNA in 30 minutes, because he went through all the nonsense he didn't want to watch, and he could get a feel for what happened within 30 minutes of probably 8 or 9 episodes of the show. And that's just, I mean, that's just what we run into today. But you said something before. You said kayfabe is dead, but not really, because kayfabe commentaries goes on. So let's go back to your company real quick and talk about some of the titles you have. And I guess what's been your most popular title, your most popular series, and then maybe what's your most popular You Shoot?
You Shoot is maybe the most popular in that it's a very democratic series. The fans ask all the questions via email and video to the guests. So that's a very, very popular concept. Guest Booker, for those that are maybe have a little more interest in the creative aspect of the business and all the type of things we've been talking about for the last few minutes, there's the Guest Booker series. For the historian in you, we have our Timeline series, Timeline, the History of WWE, and this year we actually just spun off a series called Timeline, the History of ECW. The first installment was Sabu, covering the year 1997, and Shane Douglas will cover 1994. That comes out in October. Our current release, we are in the middle of what we're calling the Summer of You Shoot, a very heavy concentration on You Shoot titles. The second Honky Tonk Man appearance on You Shoot was last month's release. Our current release is Perry Saturn, seemingly from the depths of nowhere, emerges Perry Saturn with a very harrowing story to tell. And he's the current month's You Shoot release. We have Danny Doring coming up next, and we're actually taking submissions. I think today's the last day, actually, for submissions for Yushu China, which will be happening in a few weeks' time. We're going to make another announcement later today about the next Yushu that we'll be taking solicitations for. It's a very popular series. People are pretty quick to say that it revolutionized the shoot DVD industry, and I probably agree with them. Kind of definitely raised the bar, or at least forced folks to make it interesting again. And www.kfadecommentaries.com has more info on those series and more.
I'm looking forward to the second part of Honky Tonk Man, because I got the first one, and obviously I'm a big Honky Tonk Man fan, so I thought he was very honest and very genuine, and I'm looking forward to the second one as well. And I guess with Perry Saturn, we of course posted the trailers, a couple of different trailers you had for the Perry Saturn, I guess, Back from Hell. One of the interesting aspects of the trailer you put out was that Perry Saturn was talking about drug testing in WCW, and he failed a drug test. And so the powers that be said, hey, you know, hey, Perry, you failed this drug test. What are you going to do about it? And he said, well, just stop testing me. It's like that, you know, you hear so many stories about WCW, and that's probably the reason that WCW is where WCW is today. So I'm looking forward to that Perry Saturn one as well. So, and I guess with Perry Saturn, where was he all this time? How did you find him? And when you did find him, was he willing to talk? Because I know he'd been really reclusive over the last number of years. People couldn't find him. People would call him, and they couldn't get in contact with him. So when you got in contact with him, was he kind of willing to do this? And I guess how did the interview go overall?
Perry was a drug addict in WCW and WWE. Ironically enough, though, not in ECW, go figure. But later on, he had gotten hooked, and his life really spiraled out of control with addiction, and he eventually threw it all away, wrestling and big house and cars, and he was homeless. He was homeless in a couple of cities, Atlanta, Minneapolis, and living on the streets, committing crimes for drugs, and was involved in a shooting. He was shot twice, once in the neck and once in the collarbone. Somehow his wife also became addicted to crystal meth, and she died while they were together. And he came out of it. He cleaned himself up, hid the fact that he was Perry Saturn or a professional wrestler or anything from people in his street life, and did anything he could to survive, collected debts for drug dealers, robbed. I mean, it's a really incredible story. But Perry, I think Yushu was very much a confessional. For Perry, it felt very much like that for me, and I think you'll feel the same when you see it. He made no excuses. He took total accountability for what he had done and what he had become, and said, you know, that was behind him, that he lives with the struggle of trying to get past that now. And he was very open and very honest and very good-natured about talking about this stuff and going along with the lightheartedness of Yushu. Yushu is usually a very kind of a light series, comical, and we play crazy games with the guys and stuff. And he went along with all that stuff too. It's really, really an interesting addition to the show. It's Yushu Perry Saturn, also available at kfadecommentaries.com. Anyone who has any interest in classic ECW or Saturn or this type of stuff, it's a very, very interesting release.
I look forward to it, because obviously I was a big ECW fan on Perry Saturn, the Eliminators from back in the day. I'm looking forward to that one. And I guess, you know, getting away from the tragedy of his life and maybe going on a little bit of a more positive note, obviously, you know, like you and I, big wrestling fans growing up, we wouldn't be in this industry if we weren't wrestling fans. Is there anybody that you came in contact with, either you contacted or that you got a chance to interview, that you just kind of like totally marked out for, like, man, I grew up idolizing this guy, and suddenly here I am talking to this person.
No, God, I think a mindset changes when you become a business owner.
Yeah.
A little switch gets flipped, I guess. No, I haven't really had the markout moment yet. I've had a lot of guys that I respected that I was impacted by in some way, that it was great to talk to. Superstar Billy Graham was a real key moment for me in kind of the company coming full circle, because he was the first image I saw on television in wrestling. I was over at a friend's house and I saw Superstar Billy Graham on television, and that's how I was hooked. Probably in 77 or 78, right in that title run. He was on TV being, you know, bombastic and flamboyant and outrageous and brutal. And he was unlike anything I'd ever seen on television. And, you know, my wide-eyed six-year-old, you know, eyes saw him as like, you know, the superhero villain, the villain to a superhero, you know, and so then working with him, it was kind of interesting. I think I may have even told him that he was the first image I ever saw in wrestling. And there's a good example. We were talking before about uniqueness and how they don't make them like that anymore. There's a fine example of what the captivating element of wrestling really was, that ingredient that's so missing today. I mean, you know, they wind up Flair and push him out there still, and he's still a real talented guy, and he still does have that captivating element, but there's a lot of Superstar Billy Graham in him, you know. So no, I haven't had the markout moment. That might come a little bit if I work with Piper. If we ever come to terms with Piper, we've gone around the block a couple of times with Piper with a couple of different ideas and haven't been able to find that middle ground yet. But if that ever comes to pass, there may be a small bit of the 12-year-old in me that went to school dressed as Roddy Piper in seventh grade.
Do you have the hot rod shirt?
I had the old school one, man. I had the Black Panther's head with the iron-on hot rod letters in the back. I did show that to him once. I met Roddy. We haven't done a video, but I showed him a picture. I said, "Where did this shirt come from?" He had that for a little while when he first came in, and then they started, you know, the WWF machine started mass producing the hot rod shirts. And he said it. He goes, "I was just in a store. I saw the thing, and, you know, when I was doing TV that night, I thought it looked cool, so I had them put it on a T-shirt." Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, I remember that Macho Man shirt from the 80s, the purple one with his glasses on it. I mean, I used to wear that thing everywhere. That was like, it's like that old sweater. Like, even when it was old and it was, you know, getting toward the end of its run, he still wanted to wear that old Macho Man T-shirt. And, yeah, you know, going back to what you were saying before about characters and creativity, I mean, there's Rowdy Roddy Piper and Superstar Billy Graham, adorable Adrian Adonis, Rowdy Roddy Piper, Superfly Jimmy. They're just, today, there's just John Cena, Alex Riley, you know, Randy Orton. I mean, no knocks against these guys, but I mean, when you compare them to back in the day, I mean, just the characters are so much different. Listen,
conceivably, if you were a young wrestler in the late 70s, early 80s, you could have found yourself riding in a car on a, you know, 255-mile trip between Harley Race, Roddy Piper, Ric Flair, and Gary Hart. That's like going to wrestling college for 4 hours. I mean, and today, you could conceivably find yourself riding in a car between The Miz, John Cena, and Alex Riley. sit with that for a few minutes, Steve.
Wow. That's... And probably a couple of the divas thrown in that would know probably even less than them guys.
Exactly. One car would be it would feel like hanging with your college buddies. The other car would be an education. It would probably end you up in rehab, but it would have been an education nonetheless to ride with a crew like that. Although, actually, the names I mentioned, I don't know if rehab would apply. Maybe the Piper. We'll change the players. Piper, Adrian Adonis, and Don Morocco, and then Bob Orton. That car would have landed you in rehab or prison.
You know, what's funny is when we talked, I know you talked to Dutch Mantel for one of your series too. Dutch Mantel, when we interviewed him, he was talking about when he was getting into the business, a young wrestler, he'd just drive around with these guys, you know, all these legendary wrestlers, and they would tell him stories, and he would just sit there and absorb it all. And yet, you know, a lot of them, he was the designated driver, so, you know, they were telling all kinds of stories because they were drinking and partying, and yet he just sat there and absorbed it all. And I'm thinking, like you said, who is there today that you can absorb it all? There's just nobody to teach these guys like they did back in the day.
No, there isn't. I mean, you've got the locker room vets like Undertaker and who the hell else is there?
Who's left anymore? I mean, Shawn Michaels is gone. Bret Hart's not there anymore.
Yeah,
Triple H is in the office now. So who is there to really, you know, mold these guys into to become a big time superstar?
Maybe you should do it.
Well,
maybe
you
should throw your hat in the ring. Send a letter to Connecticut. You know how they like hiring people who are interested in wrestling in any capacity. Don't say you run Gerwick.net. Say you used to write for the Golden Girls or something.
And, there you go.
Or eight when, is like, enough.
One day at a time.
Right. You used to write for One Day at a Time. You'll be hired in an instant. He's a Hollywood writer. He belongs in wrestling.
Oh, no. Actually, it should probably be One Life to Live or All My Children, right? That's what they're looking for, the soap opera writers, right? Yeah.
Yeah, you'd be better qualified as a soap opera writer.
General Hospital. There you go. Is there any soap operas left anymore? I know they got rid of a couple of the afternoon soap operas.
Yeah, no, I don't even know. I think they announced this year they were folding. I'm on Guiding Light a few times back in my on-camera acting days. I guess it was CBS Guiding Light. And those things are run like sweatshops. But I digress.
What's been like, I know there's probably, you've done so many of them, but is there a memorable interview that really sticks out and say, you know, every time I think of about an interview, I think about this interview?
One that we sometimes reminisce with at Kayfabe Commentaries, the Bruno and Harley, the great debate. We did it was during the presidential debates. We said, wouldn't it be great to bring in Harley Race as a representative of the classic NWA territory system, and Bruno Sammartino as a representative of the WWF and a champion that didn't have to do the loop, and do a presidential-style debate on just kind of general wrestling topics. So we did a DVD which was called Race Sammartino, the Great Debate 08, which was kind of just a bizarre experiment. I talk about it now. I can't believe we did it, but we did, and it was kind of wild. But that shoot and spending time with those guys, more what happened off camera, they could not have been more different. I mean, they're similar in their makeup, and that their constitution is very much old school, and they're both really great representatives of that bygone era that we've talked about. But as people, like during a break, Harley lights up a cigarette. Bruno from across the room looks like, Harley, you're still smoking? Like he couldn't believe it. Harley sits there very smugly eating his fried chicken. Goes, yup. And, you know, Bruno had just had like a boiled chicken with steamed broccoli. And it's just the dynamic. The two of them were so opposite in their lifestyle choices. Bruno said that he was tired. He had been up since 6. Harley said he doesn't get up till about noon these days. He can't go to sleep until midnight. They were both very different, and that was fascinating to me to watch them sit there. And I was just observing all these little snippets of their conversations that were so polar opposite. Yet when they sat on camera and they talked about the pride and the integrity with which they viewed their era of wrestling, they were so uniquely similar. That was a fascinating dichotomy, which obviously didn't come across because, you know, viewers didn't spend that personal time with them. But that's something that we talk about and laugh about all the time at the company.
Yeah, as I said, that just shows the creative and innovative products you bring to the wrestling consumers out there. That's awesome. Going back, you said something about Roddy Piper, that you wanted to work with Roddy Piper, that you may do something with him down the line. I guess I was going to ask you, is there anybody that you really, really wanted that refused you, that just won't come on and do the gig?
Well, the U-shoot concept scares some people, and I understand that, and I respect that, because I'd rather have them say, oh, I really don't want to come on and talk about personal stuff, than my ask them something on camera and then be evasive, because the whole concept of You Shoot is that it's 100% democratic and uncensored. You ask anything you want of the star and they will answer it. So, you know, if you can't give me that, then don't come on. So I've had some people not want to come on and do You Shoot. Just maybe they're protective of their past, or they don't want to rehash some things they might be very proud of. But the other shows, like Guest Booker, Guest Booker, I couldn't convince. I had a half-hour phone conversation with Jerry Lawler a couple of years ago. He was going to be the second or third guest on Guest Booker, and he just was not having it. He didn't get the concept. He didn't understand why booking was important. He actually said to me, he goes, who the f*** is going to watch this? I said, people are interested in booking and creative. But he said, really? I said, yes.
Armchair bookers out there, you know, we all do that, right?
And he said, sure. He goes, it's going to be a very short DVD. He said, because I made it up in the car on the way to the taping. And I said, oh. But he wasn't into it and couldn't convince him. Pat Patterson wouldn't do it. I think Pat still believes in, you know, the protection of the creative elements of the business somewhat.
Sure.
He doesn't speak out very publicly about wrestling. He occasionally does a little spot on WWE Classics, talking in very general terms about stuff that happened in wrestling history. But I don't really think he's cool with exposing too much about the business, which I respect that too. God, I'd love to have him, though. I tried. So I sent, this is true, and this is I'm the subject of a lot of jokes within my company. I sent fruit baskets, very beautiful, decorative Harry and David fruit baskets to Pat Patterson's house with copies of the Guest Booker DVDs for a period of time to try and woo him, to try and court him into doing Guest Booker, and it did not work. So that's somebody I would have liked to have had on that show.
Fruit baskets, Pat Patterson.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. I guess that opens a whole can of worms there too. But it was very honestly with the best of intent, and it wasn't just fruit baskets. They were, I think some nuts in there too. Well, that didn't help my argument very much there either. But
I guess on the flip side of that, of having guys that refused you, is there anybody that kind of maybe you didn't necessarily reach out to that kind of reached out to you and said, hey, you know, Sean, I saw this series or I heard about your DVDs, and maybe somewhere down the line we can work together?
Yeah, that happens. Sometimes it's through an agent. Usually what will happen is the agent will call me and say, so-and-so's in town. He thinks he'd be great, or I think he'd be great for so-and-so. Do you have anything for him? And unfortunately, because we're very disciplined with production, and, you know, if you're going to run a successful company, you have to be. But also the integrity of the shows, you don't want it on the brand or the individual personality of the show. So the right talent has to be right for the show. There are some people I just don't have anything for, either at that time or in general. I mean, I don't know what I would do with a particular talent sometimes when the agent calls. But there are times where people were fans of the show and wanted to come on. I know X-Pac will tell you he was jonesing to get on You Shoot for so long, and he was just such a tremendous guest. He was great. I can't wait to bring him back. There's definitely a timeline in Sean Waltman that should be recorded. Who else sought us out? I got an email today from someone that knew Jack has posted all over his Facebook page that he needs to get in touch with the You Shoot people to talk about the sexually transmitted disease accusations with him and Terry. I don't know. This is what I sent an email this morning about it, so I'll have to look into that.
But I was wondering, yeah, you know, with your business, and obviously you've been very successful with these different titles, and the last couple of years, obviously maybe the last, I don't know, 2, 3, 4 years now, we've kind of been kind of an economic slowdown. You know, we're hearing about these the economy not doing well, unemployment's high. I guess, has the economy affected your business overall?
Well, it hasn't really. I mean, I suppose it has. How do you know, really, is my question. We've always been able to grow revenue, so we've always moved in the right direction. We grow revenue. We meet our targets every quarter and every year since its inception. So we've always found ways to meet our goals. The DVD market as a whole is greatly challenged. Anyone will say, not even wrestling related, they'll talk to someone at Paramount Pictures and they'll tell you that what with piracy and with them basically giving programs away on Netflix and whatnot, the aftermarket for recorded product has been decimated. So it's a challenge to us to always keep things fresh and come up with concepts. Fortunately, I think our niche, wrestling fans and fans of classic wrestling and smart fans, I guess is the kind of the common term that you hear for them all the time, they still want a tangible product. There's a collectible element to what we sell. So they want to be able to hold it and put it on the shelf and have all those serial numbers line up and have everything in our collection in one place. So the DVD is not dead. For our fans, but it is a challenge to, you know, to keep things fresh and to keep things moving in the right direction. And but we're always able to do it, and I credit that to everybody that we work with here. Our programs are concept driven first and foremost. And if we don't have that concept, if we don't have that intriguing show, if we don't get the results out of the interview, if we don't market it the right way, then it won't succeed. So I credit our success to all those things.
Our fans
being very loyal. I don't want that to be lost on it either. Our fans are kind of cultish in that way. It's not unlike a Kiss fan or a Grateful Dead fan. I think when you give people their vice, we're kind of like drug dealers. When you deliver their vice and it's oh so delicious every time, and they feel that you really understand them, that you really connect, you're really delivering the product that they want, it's a passion thing. You tap into their passion, into their blood. They reward you with that loyalty. We have people that buy absolutely every release we put out every month. And, you know, if it takes more than 3 days to get there, we'll email us, where the hell is the DVD? You know, so there's that kind of passion. With that kind of passion and loyalty on their side comes a great deal of responsibility on our side that we take very seriously from a customer service standpoint. And from a programming standpoint, we have to deliver in every way. That means the physical delivery of the disc in a timely fashion, an attractive disc, and also an attractive program has to be delivered every month.
Now I'm going to put Sean in a shoot situation too, and I don't know if he'll speak to this or not, but we'll ask. Have you ever done an interview where you thought, this is going to be a great interview, and by the time you got done, you're like, oh my gosh, what happened here? Is anybody like you really had such high hopes for, and that when it was all over, you're like, what the heck happened to this?
No, I'm usually at the end of the interviews, I usually look to the crew to see how it went. I'm usually very, it depends. Interview to interview, it's different, but I'm usually very distracted by timing, getting through the material, kind of trying to match the pace that my guest is giving. Are they more verbose? Are they somebody that you can just wind up and send out there and they go, like Cornette? Does somebody need to be led a little bit? I'm very concerned with all that other stuff. So the final product from a consumer standpoint, I don't see until it goes into editing. So at the end of the shoot, I usually turn to them and say, well, what'd you think? And then I'll get their feedback. I was disappointed in guest booker Mike Graham in that he wasn't able to do any booking. We tried, and he, you know, we were in a situation where it was kind of us making suggestions, and it was kind of like us doing the booking. So he just couldn't do it. So we did an exercise at the end where he would go through the roster and choose the roster that he would want to use, but he wasn't able to do that. I think the release, though, is still a tremendous release because of the front half of the show, which was all the discussion about Florida and the Florida territory and his dad, Eddie Graham, who he was very, very close to, and he described him as his best friend, and that was very much the relationship they had. So Florida, the Grahams, from a creative standpoint, from a company standpoint, the inner workings of the Florida territory I felt was fascinating. Then we jumped over and touched on the WCW stuff a little bit, which Mike Graham was a part of that very turbulent booking committee in WCW. And, you know, we touched on that. So all that stuff was tremendous. It's just when we came to that booking exercise, he wasn't able to deliver.
Did you ever do an interview where you didn't actually put it out because it just wasn't what you were looking for? Or somebody came in just, you know, not ready to do an interview?
No.
Okay.
Well, I mean, you know, the safeguard with that is you need a good script. You know,
sure.
You need to know. We don't just write, you know, 75 questions and just that aren't intended to go anywhere. You know, we have a flow. We have a direction we want it to go. And the talent we choose, we're also pretty, you know, I've said no to people that I've known to be unreliable. Unreliable in a couple of different ways, let's just say. And we avoid problems by keeping people who shouldn't be in our programs off of our programs. We usually know going in, except for Perry Saturn, and I got to tell you, I had no idea what was going to walk in. The guy's been living on the streets for 5 years, so I had no idea what we were going to get that day. And he ended up being an unbelievable guest, tremendous.
Where do you shoot your interviews? Where's your location?
It depends. It varies. We, you know, there's no one set we have to. There are places that we favor. It's a sizable production, so we need if we're going to be in a hotel, we need a suite. So we need a hotel with a big enough suite that we can set up and shoot in a living room type setting. And we want our shows to have that kind of a smaller, homey type feel. We have deviated a little bit. We sometimes will use an all-purpose room or breakout room, they're called sometimes, at a resort, which are very big, and those are great because I have a lot of room to play with from a set design standpoint. But they're usually either in suites or in those multi-purpose rooms.
What's your schedule like? I mean, how many interviews are you currently doing, and is this like your full-time gig, or do you do something outside of the company?
No, I have my hands in a lot of different fires. I do this. I was a film and television actor for 20 years, so I still do a lot of. I do mostly voice work now in movies and television shows. I have one foot in real estate also, so I have a few things going on. What does the schedule look like? Production watching, shooting.
Yeah, how many interviews do you currently do during a month, and how do you kind of schedule that?
It's most beneficial to what I call block book, which is to do a bunch over the course of a day or two. Just from an expense standpoint, your
sure.
food expenses are minimized, your location expenses are minimized. What do we have coming up? We have, in September, we have a double shot day with You Shoot China and a You Shoot that we're going to announce this week.
Okay.
Later that same day. We have, in October, we have a pretty busy couple of days. We're doing a guest booker with Terry Taylor. Also, what else do we have on that schedule? I know there's a bunch of stuff. Another guest booker, which is kind of a cool concept we haven't announced yet. Shane Douglas will be doing this project with us that weekend also. So we have three shoots over those 2 days. Usually it would be like that, two or three shoots kind of blocked into a weekend. Oh, we have a timeline with Larry Zbysko that we're shooting in November.
Awesome.
That's coming, 1980.
Awesome. I'll look forward. I've been a big Larry Zbysko fan for a long time, so I'll be looking forward to that one. We're ending our interview here with Sean Oliver. We do appreciate his time. And I guess in closing, Sean, plug your website, plug the social networks. How can people get a hold of your material? And also, how can they preview your material, and how can they get in contact with you to submit questions for your You Shoot?
Well, the website is kayfabecommentaries.com. We're on all the social nets. Follow us on Twitter at kayfabecomment. And also find us over on Facebook, kayfabecommentaries. And you can join our email mailing list. We send you email blasts a couple of times a month, let you know what's going on. We do special things. If you follow us on the social networks, we'll sell a very limited number of signed discs every once in a while. It's called our Signature Editions. We do that to our followers on social nets. And you can submit your questions for You Shoot at www.kfabecommentaries.com. We also have the KC channel via YouTube, where we're offering for only $4.99 streaming titles, select four or five every month we put up there, and we rotate the titles, and you'll be able to look at some of our back catalog for only $4.99 right there on your computer. That's via YouTube, the KC channel. If you search for Kayfabe Commentaries on YouTube, you'll find us there. And that's it. We're very accessible. Send us emails. Talk to us on the social nets. We make us a part of your daily lives. A ton of our fans have. We were, first and foremost, I'll say this in closing, Anthony and myself, when we started this company, we were wrestling fans. We were fans. We read our news on the Internet. We watched wrestling on Monday nights. And, you know, we read on the Internet. We watched Shoot DVDs, you know, and so we have the sensibility of a fan. We're business owners, but we're fans at heart. And we want to hear from the other fans. We always want to make sure that our beliefs and our goals are aligned with what fans want, because it's fans running the company. We're out of touch. The minute we cross that line and we start putting out that nobody wants to see, or we're not keeping people engaged by tapping into that gene, that wonderful gene in us that fell in love with the mysterious and secret elements of professional wrestling. When we're not seeking to get in there and have some fun with that gene that lives in us, then we failed. So join us, talk to us, get on the social networks, email us, let us know what you like and what you know.
Yeah, definitely email Sean, and you represent Gerwick.net by submitting a question to Sean, and he'll ask a talent on You Shoot. And obviously check out kfabecommentaries.com. And, of course, if you stay on Gerwick.net, you always see Sean's advertisements as there as well, and you can always see what the current DVD or title that he's currently promoting. So we do appreciate the time, Sean. I could talk to you for hours because we just go back to our old roots and talk about the good old days of wrestling. But we do appreciate your time, and we wish you continued success. And we thank you for your sponsorship at Gerwick.net.
Thanks, Steve.